It's 14 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Last March, Philadelphia became the home for a new Pops orchestra, the Philly Pops, with conductor Peter Nero. Peter Nero is with me now, and he's in Philadelphia for the next Pops performance, which is this Monday night. The program is being called Uptown Downtown, and it will include songs from the musical 42nd Street. The special guest artist will be Vivian Reed, the star of Bubbling Brown Sugar. Peter Nero is a conductor and pianist with jazz, classical, and pop recordings to his credit. His recording of the summer of 42 went gold in 1971. He's received 2 Grammys for his work. He's a very busy man, guest conducting a number of orchestras in addition to leading the new Philly Pops. Peter Nero, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Before becoming a conductor, you were first known as a pianist. What interested you in conducting?
Well, John Williams said something on the air a month ago, and that's kind of my feelings about it. When he was composing in the studios, other conductors were conducting his music, and he said he sort of got into conducting by self-defense. I thought that was an appropriate phrase, and that's exactly what happened to me, because almost everything that I was playing with the symphony orchestras that I was guesting with were my arrangements or compositions. And while we had a lot of very fine conductors there was always a tendency on a Pops night for the conductors to sort of treat it very lightly, which meant that they didn't prepare. So I felt that everything that was going on was really not true to what it should have been.
Exactly what can a conductor do to undermine your work?
Well, probably the lack of preparation is the most serious violation. Not taking it seriously, understanding that there are musical values in there that have to be brought out, and that it takes rehearsal and it takes some thought. It's not just something that plays itself. This is the kind of arrangements that I write. Actually, the kind of arrangements that I write are really traditional in the sense that the players have to play them. It's not the kind of a thing that's going to sound good no matter who's doing it. And that generally was a Pops formula, where the arrangements were done in such a way as they were just, frankly, just simplistic. Not just simple, but simplistic. So, as a matter of fact, it was right here at Ambler, at the Temple University Music Festival one summer, that the conductor hurt his back during rehearsal, and I was sort of forced to take over that night. And it was that night that I decided, after conducting the orchestra, that this is what I was going to do from then on.
No, that was before you studied conducting, though, right?
Oh, no, I had studied in college and at Juilliard.
What are some of the things you've learned about conducting an orchestra now that you've been doing it for some time?
Well, it's been about 10 years now. Oh, it's been an awful lot. When I look back on those early days when I first conducted, I wonder how I had the nerve to get up there.
What were you doing wrong?
Well, it's not so much a question of doing things wrong. It's not really being experienced. And, of course, that is always the problem in any profession, is that you cannot get the job until you have the experience, but you can't get the experience until you get the job. So, in a sense, I was lucky that I fell into it and did get the chance to learn as I was going along. The orchestra is an instrument, and of course you have to play it, but it's not the same as this. That's where the similarity ends. Even though it's an instrument, it's composed of human beings, so each orchestra is different. They all have personalities of their own, and they are going to play in a certain way, and you can change it just so much. So in a sense, you're really there to help them sound as good as their potential is. And this is where the musicianship comes in. I really don't think that there's a great difference in conducting an orchestra and playing an instrument in the approach. Because just as you would practice pieces on your own on an instrument, likewise you would rehearse an orchestra in the same way. When I rehearse them, I am listening to them. I'm sort of their ears collectively. And if I hear things in there that I do not think will sound well, then it's my job at that point to correct them. Of course, some people have said that when it comes to interpreting music, tempo is everything. And I do believe that that is very important. Because that's what makes a big difference between one conductor and another, is the tempos that he chooses.
If I were to come and watch you conduct in a rehearsal, and then came and saw you conduct in a performance, what would some of the differences be in what I was seeing?
Well, I have found that if you don't get it done in the rehearsal, you won't get it at the performance. So the rehearsal becomes most important. And in today's musical world, rehearsal is very short. It is not the kind of a situation that existed many, many years ago, where you just kept on doing it until you got it as best as possible. So now we have to work to get it as best as possible within the limitations of time.
Is that an ironic situation for you to be in, since you got into this in the first place feeling that not enough time was spent preparing on the part of conductors for a performance?
In a sense, there's two ways of looking at it. First of all, I have found, for instance, when I was a soloist rehearsing with other orchestras and other conductors, that even though the orchestra was playing it exceptionally well and had, in my opinion, peaked for the rehearsal, the conductors kept on rehearsing because they had another half hour left. And this is one of the reasons that orchestras are so adamant about rehearsal time staying the way it is. So it does force the conductor to be very economical and not to rehearse just for his own gratification, but just to get it up to that point. There are a lot of conductors who are very popular with orchestras because they know when to stop. They know when to let the orchestra save it for the performance at night. Over-rehearsing can be just as bad as under-rehearsing. So it really means that you have to be very careful in using your time so that you don't dwell on things that are going to be good at night anyway. So you have to know the difference as to what has to be changed in rehearsal and what is going to go well that night, even though it may not sound the greatest, especially when you're dealing with new music. Now, a lot of the things we do are brand new for the orchestra. They've never seen the parts before. Other things are traditional repertoire that they have played all their lives. So there are many concerts that have been done by orchestras with conductors where they haven't rehearsed at all, just simply for the fact that the conductor missed the plane and couldn't get there in time for the rehearsal, and they have gone exceptionally well. And orchestra players who know the repertoire will tell you that they don't have to rehearse it. They know it.
Things like that make you wonder whether the conductor is there more for the audience, more as a frontman or an actor for the audience, or more for the orchestra as a way to shape or to reshape the music that you're going to be hearing.
I think it's definitely a combination of both. But of course, orchestras, when they first started to become orchestras, had no conductors at all. So the conductor was an addition that came about. It's a long story in itself. So it all depends on the conductor's conception of what his role is.
What are some of the things that you do for the sake of the audience?
Nothing. I mean, in terms of looking good up there?
Well, sometimes I think that the more flamboyant a conductor, the more a conductor hams it up, the more the audience is going to really appreciate it and think that they're a great conductor. If you wave your arms a lot.
This is always a problem that the conductor has to consider. Now, there are certain pieces where the conductor can really put an audience to sleep. And one of them, for instance, is Ravel's Bolero, where his job is just to keep time and to keep the dynamics correct. And, of course, to me, that one, not only the dynamics, but the tempo in that one is the most important thing, because it does have a tendency to go up and down, and you have to figure out where it's sagging, where it's pushing ahead, and how to think of the thing cohesively. That's an interesting piece, because it is the same theme 8 times repeated with varied orchestration, so it must build. But I have found, especially with Ravel's Bolero, but in general, I've found that every performance is different every night. So it all depends on how it is going, and it's my job at that point to conceive of the thing in terms of the space of time and to say, okay, now it is beginning to need something at this point, so I'll push it. The night before, I might have just let it go or even held it back for that matter. But it is difficult for the audience at that point because the conductor doesn't have that much to do in throwing cues and so forth or to look physical. So in cases like that, if it will help the audience feel the music more, yes, I will do something that will be considered visual and not really essential to the music. But 99% of the time, I think most conductors will tell you this, if they are sincere about the music, is that whatever they're doing up there is to help the musicians.
Is most of what you're doing there for the musicians giving them cues, or do you feel like you also have to be doing something that's going to help inspire them or push them? Or is there anything you could do at that point to get a better performance of individuals?
Whatever has to be done, I will do. And that just is a question of trial and error, depending on which orchestra you're conducting. If it's your own orchestra, they know you well enough, so they know what to expect of you. And I know what they want of me, I can tell. You get with as a guest conductor with other orchestras, you can do a dance up there, it doesn't make a difference. It all depends on who their own conductor is and how they've been trained. There are conductors who are just hardly move at all. And the orchestra, I think Fritz Reiner was famous for that, where if he raised his little finger, that was fortissimo. And if he raised a little less, that was mezzo forte and so forth. So his motions were very within a small area. So it all depends on what the orchestra needs. It's as simple as that. If I feel like they're not getting enough of an accent in there, and I've told them in rehearsal and it hasn't happened on the performance, the next time we come to that accent, let's say 2 bars later, I will turn around to them and really glare or dig in or make exaggerated motions for that moment until I get what I think should be.
How can you practice or rehearse as a conductor?
In front of a mirror, usually. I always like to see how the orchestra sees me. And I always picture what it would be like to sit in the orchestra, and if I was looking at the conductor, would it be clear? Well, what I would like and what they would like, I have to find that difference in there. And, of course, every player is different, so, again, you have to gauge. There are some players that just, all they want to know is where, just tell me where one is, and I'll go from there. And there are others who like to be cued, and others who don't like to be cued. So again, it's a question of just finding out as you go along. The most difficult thing is to be a guest conductor, because you're conducting somebody else's orchestra, and the orchestra has a way of playing, and especially when you're doing traditional repertoire. And I had a conversation, it was just last summer, we did excerpts from the Carmen Suite, and it was with one of the symphonies down south, a very good one, and I've played with them maybe 20 times, and we did this piece for the first time, for me. In other words, my first time conducting them in this piece. And we have limited rehearsal time, and we ran through it, and to me it was not what I wanted. And I went back over certain spots to see if I could get them to get the idea. And the performance was much closer to what I wanted, but still not there. And I spoke to the concertmaster, and I asked him, I said, what is lacking? And he says, you have to understand, we've played this piece hundreds of times. And he says, we've played it in the same way, and we sort of locked into this way of playing it. And it's very difficult for us to start to change now. So he says, we do the best we can for you, but that's as good as we can do. Mm. Now, this is going to happen with anybody. And I don't know if a conductor will tell you this, but that's as simple as it is.
All right. Peter Nero is my guest, if you're just joining us, and he's in town for the next performance of the Philly Pops, which is this Monday evening. The performance is being called Uptown Downtown, and it's going to feature guest performer Vivian Reed, who you may know from Bubbling Brown Sugar. The Boston Pops is the oldest Pops orchestra in the country. How do you think the Philly Pops compares and differs with the Boston Pops?
Well, the Boston Pops is basically Boston Symphony Orchestra players without the principals. We are a separate entity. The orchestra is composed of members of a group in Philadelphia called the Concerto Soloists, plus people from, as a matter of fact, these same people, too, play for the ballet and for the opera, and we have a lot of Curtis people in there. So we have a nice balance of experience and youth, so we get what I like to call exuberance. What that really boils down to is an orchestra that wants to play, an orchestra that's not jaded, an orchestra that's excited about what's going on. Plus the fact that the kind of music we're playing is so varied that it is very challenging for them. They have to change gears very quickly. We don't divide the program as Boston does into two halves. Traditionally, what Arthur Fiedler used to do is do the classical portion in the first half and the pop in the second. We mix it up throughout the concert.
How come?
Well, my reasoning is that these labels are man-made, and there's nothing that says that you can't do it. If somebody asked me, why do you do this? And the only answer I could say is, why not? I mean, who says it has to be otherwise? I feel that if we can tear down these labels and take the music for what it is, first of all, we are bringing music to people who normally have it removed from them, kind of on a pedestal. It's kind of an elitist kind of attitude that has been perpetuated throughout the centuries, really. That this kind of music is for certain people and not for others. And this to me is false, because there is value in that music and substance there for these people to grab onto. And for instance, some of the things that we are doing in the classical repertoire, the people know the melodies, but they do not know them to identify them. So if we are going to do the third movement of the Rachmaninoff Second Symphony, that will scare a lot of people away. But if I explain to them that two pop songs were taken from this, one was I Can't Get Started With You about 40 years ago, and more recently a song called Never Gonna Fall in Love Again by Eric Carmen, who was a music student out of Cleveland. Then suddenly they realize that this is not so far removed from them, and I enjoy presenting it to them in its original form. So this way, in mixing it up, I'm showing them that music is music, and it really doesn't matter whether it's called rock or jazz. See, pop to me is just a catch-all term. All it means is that we are, to me it means freedom to do whatever we feel like doing and whatever I think the audience will like.
Well, how do you choose the repertoire? How do you put together a show? Most of the shows so far have been thematic. Under which the repertoire is organized.
Yeah, they've been thematic, but with leaving a lot of room. One show is called From Broadway to Hollywood. Okay, well, that leaves me, so I'm wide open. For the Hollywood things, I was able to do classical things that have been used as background scores for most motion pictures. So we did pictures at an exhibition, and there, and that's been used to death. Everything else has, too. So it was just a simple matter of taking things that I thought in the classical repertoire that the audience would enjoy. And we backed that up, I think, with The Wiz, because that was from Broadway. And by the way, the pop arrangements that we have are different also in terms of Boston, in that they have a formula that has worked over the years, and they've kept it.
What's that formula?
Music that doesn't get in anybody's way, doesn't hurt anybody, so that The Wiz is going to sound like Rodgers and Hammerstein, or Rodgers and Hammerstein will sound like the next pop tune and so forth. And it's a kind of writing and approach that is fine and works for the people of Boston and so forth. They are fulfilling that role for people. I feel there's no point in us doing the same thing, and I never have. So what I do is to take the same serious approach to pop music as we do to classical music. So in other words, if we're going to play The Wiz, the arrangement is going to sound like rock and roll or disco. That's what it's going to sound like. That's what it should be. And it's just as if you're being true to the composer or to the original format of it.
Now, how do you take a rock and roll tune, which people basically associate with the record, which may have a couple of guitars, a bass, drums, maybe a lead singer, and translate that into an orchestral arrangement and still preserve
how
the
integrity? How do we do it with great difficulty? It all depends on the original. For instance, The Wiz, that I was referring to before, it took three songs from that, all of which I felt had good melodic content. So when you're dealing with a good melody, then it's simple to present it instrumentally. Working with something like Saturday Night Fever, which I did an arrangement of 14 minutes of Saturday Night Fever, on that one I felt that the recording was so strong and that the style and the production of the recording was so unique that I try to capture that rather than just take the songs and do something different with them. So that was a tough one, and on that one I had to use guitar. That's the only time I've ever used guitar for any of our concerts. So I try to stay away from using anything unconventional. None of the arrangements that I write have saxophones in them either. So in other words, we don't have to bring in a band. So it still is a symphony orchestra that can be a band, that can be flexible enough. And of course, that how to make that sound like what it should requires a different style of writing. There are plenty of writers around the country that can do this kind of thing, but they are not asked to do it. In other words, the symphonies are saying, hold back because we want this to be bland. We want this to be, don't get in anybody's way. I call it elevator music, and I really consciously try to stay away from it.
Now, another significant difference between the way a rock or a jazz recording is going to sound and what you're going to hear in an orchestra is the drumming. There's very different kinds of drumming, I think, that you'll find in both places. How do you work with the rhythm or the rhythm section?
I have a rhythm section that is always with me. It's the same rhythm section that I take with me around the country on all my symphony guest dates and also the trio concert dates that we do, where I am just a pianist and not a conductor. And they sit right up front. They are not buried in the percussion section. In other words, the bass player is not off in a corner somewhere. So they are a very important part of what goes on. In a sense, it's like a band in that case. But it goes much deeper than that because they are not playing all the time. It's not a drone. They are in and out, but when they are there, their presence is felt, and they provide the rhythmic coloring that is necessary to be true to the style in which we're writing.
I think people who look down at pop's orchestras feel that pop's orchestras try to make music more palatable, and in doing that, things are smoothed out, things are made sweeter, and that some of the integrity of the music is lost. React to that.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, you're positively right. But the only people that feel that way are those who really don't know. I think the general public that comes in doesn't feel that way at all. The general public has much more open mind, and they're the ones that are really willing to accept an awful lot, especially if it's presented to them in a palatable way, not the music, but the approach to it.
Well, what's in the approach?
Well, see if I can explain this correctly. You really have to be there to... Well, first of all, as I had mentioned before, the fact that we mix it up, that is you know, placing the music right in their laps and saying, okay, here, I'm going to give you Saturday Night Fever, and I'm also giving you Beethoven's Ninth, which we did at our May concerts. We did the last movement of the Beethoven Ninth with full chorus and soloists. And the performance of that, I was so proud of that one because they were really super. The performers were just marvelous, and the performance, the end result, was as good as any major symphony orchestra in the country. The point is the players are capable of that. This is where their roots are. So what we are really developing is an orchestra that can do both, that can play authentic pops. Now, I don't mean pop, but authentic popular music, as we had just described before. And at the same time, when they play anything in the traditional repertoire, it will sound correct and it will sound exciting. So we really can do both. And in that sense, we are unique because we are not splitting the difference. As you might hear a pops orchestra, or I should say a pops orchestra, a symphony orchestra on a pops night, what they will do is they will play pop music. It'll be nice, and they will play semi-classical, or that term which I hate, or light classical, which I also hate, but that's what most people understand, and that will sound nice also. We try to get away from that. We try to make everything sound as it should. In other words, exciting.
Do you have to listen to the radio or go to... go to diners and listen to jukeboxes a lot to see what's in the air, what people are hearing, what's really popular and getting played a lot?
No. Isn't that much around now that's taking over everything. It's really becoming a smaller segment of the population now that is responsible for the top 40 recordings. And there are certain things in the top 40 recordings that I feel that are just not meant for us. They're not meant for our audiences. They're not meant for us to play. That even if we played them, those people that like those records wouldn't come to hear us do it anyway. So if I find something that is of redeeming value in the charts, I will take that and present it. But there is very little, because most of the recordings that come out, in truth and in substance, are very thin. Melodically, it's monotonous, repetitious, sounds like what just came out before it. Harmonically, it's boring. And since we're not concerned with the lyrics in this case, we can't pass judgment on that. The productions, the recordings themselves, are very sophisticated and very complicated, which can never be reproduced on a concert stage. So that is why it is difficult. Most of the music that seems to be coming out that is melodic is coming from some of the Broadway shows, like the Hamlish things or what Vivian Reed is going to be doing. 42nd Street, the songs from that show were all written by Harry Warren, and they're all in the 1930s. So we're going back now to the 30s.
But that's mostly where you look for the popular repertoire to the stage.
Well, there are no boundaries. Whatever has got it musically will be presented, regardless of where it comes from. What I'm saying is that there is very little coming in the top 40s on the charts. And part of to substantiate that, it's very simple. The songs that are on the top 40 charts are up and they're down and out. You never hear them again.
Do you feel like you're in competition at all with the Philadelphia Orchestra?
No, not at all.
Why not?
Because we don't do what they do, and they don't do what we do. By the way, before we got this started, we got their blessing on it. When this was discussed, which was back last year during the summer, and our first concerts, by the way, were November of last year, and when it was in the discussion stage, Mosepti, who was our impresario, went to the Philadelphia Orchestra and said, I would like to do a pop series. And they said, we just don't have the time. We haven't done a pops concert since 1976. And it was ironic because in 76, I was the one that had done it with them. So they gave Mo their blessing and said, you know, please go ahead because you can fulfill a need for the community that we just don't have the time to do.
So you probably also have a different kind of audience than the orchestra, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. We have an audience that wants to hear a pops concert. By the same token, there are some crossovers there. But I feel that what we are presenting there will not only keep our audiences happy, but at the same time send some of them to the Philadelphia Orchestra, because they'll be hearing pieces that the Philadelphia Orchestra plays, and they normally would not have gone to a Philadelphia Orchestra or any symphony orchestra concert.
Peter Nero is my guest, if you're just joining us, and we're talking about the Philly Pops, which he will be conducting again this Monday night in a performance that they're calling Uptown Downtown, and the guest is going to be Vivian Reed of Building Brown Sugar. Now, through all of this traveling that you're doing, guest conducting across the country, leading the Philly Pops, you're also keeping up your work as a pianist. What kind of practicing do you have to maintain in your schedule as you're jetting around?
Well, most of it is just simply to stay in shape. So I do that at home before I leave. And once I start performing, it just takes warm-up before that. It's the open days where I don't have to play that I have to go practice. So I find a piano at the Academy or at Curtis, and I'll do about an hour, just to stay in shape.
Can you ever get a piano moved into a hotel room?
Yes, I've had that done if I stay for a period of time. But I'm pretty close to the Academy, so there really isn't too much of a problem.
Right, I've always wondered what that would be like.
I've had
that. Not that I need one, I'll tell you.
I've had that, but I'll tell you, it would have to be a piano that is equivalent to what I'm playing on stage. Otherwise, the actions are usually so light that it just doesn't give you any kind of a fight, and I might as well just warm up on a desk.
Could you tell us what's going to be happening on the program Monday night?
Sure. We are going to, I won't tell you what the first thing is, because that's a little bit of a surprise. The second thing will be a tribute to Richard Rodgers. This is something that I wrote. I was commissioned to write it for the Chautauqua Festival in New York in August. And it's 20 minutes of Richard Rodgers' songs. There are 12 songs presented in their entirety, and another 24 themes worked in, so that it's not just a medley. It becomes more of a sort of a montage of his work. Then that's for piano and orchestra with rhythm section. And then following that, Vivian Reed will do about 20 minutes, which she'll be singing songs from Bubbling Brown Sugar and a few other things. And from what I've heard of the recording, she really is a super singer. Then after that, so that'll close the first half. The second half, we'll not close the first half. We're going to insert in there the Rachmaninoff movement that I mentioned to you before. Especially since I can't get started from you, can't get started with you comes from, I still have jet lag, by the way, comes from that era in the 30s. And again, it gives me a good chance to play a piece that I think the audience will like and that I love. The second half will start off with the last movement of the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony. It has nothing to do with 1930 whatsoever. And I'll probably find a good excuse to fit it into the concept of uptown, downtown, because maybe he lived in uptown Moscow or downtown Stalingrad. I don't know. But of course, it wasn't Stalingrad then. But I like to play it, and I think the audience will enjoy it. So we will do it. Vivian Reed will return, and then after that, we will do 5 songs from 42nd Street.
With Vivian Reed?
No. This will be strictly instrumental. However, on this one, we have 3 different arrangers, and they were written specially for this concert. So we're going to get some variety in there. And I wrote one of the arrangements. Bill Holcomb has written 2. Don Rose, who wrote an album for the Buffalo Philharmonic, which was called Gershwin on Broadway, has done 1. And a gentleman who plays with our orchestra, name is Lou DeLeese, is writing 1. See, I am trying to encourage members of the orchestra who have written things before to write for us, because I think they have a good grasp of what we're out for. So I think we'll get a nice variety there. It's just as if we're going to be playing 3 different composers. So the approach will be different on each one.
Okay, well, this program is coming up Monday evening, and again, the program's being called Uptown Downtown.
And Sunday afternoon.
Oh, and Sunday afternoon, too. Okay, good. Well, ironically, we're going to hear a record now of you playing with the Boston Pops, the aforementioned Boston Pops. We'll be hearing the last movement of Gershwin's Concerto in F. Do you want to say anything about the experience of recording this before we hear it?
Well, the way these recordings were made, because I did 2 albums with them. And what you do is you play 2 concerts of the same music with the orchestra. And that, of course, has 2 rehearsals in front. And then when the concerts are over, we record the entire album in 1 session in 3 hours. 3 microphones are hung from the ceiling at Orchestra Hall. And the orchestra is seated on the floor rather than on the stage. And we play everything essentially once. And then maybe a few spots, and those things are inserted. But there's very little to be done in mixing afterwards and in editing. And that performance, I think, was recorded in 1965, I believe. It's about 15 years ago. I've mellowed a bit since then, and don't play it quite as fast. But somebody once remarked that the tempo of the last movement indicates that possibly the orchestra would double park during the record session. Anyway, tempo is a matter of taste.
Okay, well, before we hear this, I just want to ask you one final thing, Peter Nero. What are your goals with the Philly Pops? What would you like to see the orchestra become?
I would like to see it become, or rather continue to be, as unique as it is now, and to continue to be as versatile as possible, and possibly to be the basis of what a lot of orchestras in the country should be able to do, not become, but do, to be proficient playing all kinds of music, and to kind of lend a legitimacy to what has been referred to as pops, which, as you had said earlier in the interview, tends to have a connotation of being insignificant. We are trying to make it as significant, and this, of course, will be reflected in the writing and in the performance.
Okay, well, Peter Nero, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this afternoon. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Peter Nero is the conductor of the Philly Pops, who has performances this Sunday and Sunday afternoon and Monday evening. Again, the program is called Uptown Downtown. The guest artist is singer Vivian Reed, who's well known for her work in Bubbling Brown Sugar. Well, onwards to the aforementioned recording. This is Peter Nero as the piano soloist with the Boston Pops under the direction of the late Arthur Fiedler. This is the last movement of Gershwin's Concerto in F. Thank you. Peter Nero, the piano soloist with the Boston Pops, conducted by the late Arthur Fiedler. We heard the last movement of George Gershwin's Concerto in F.